It is wonderful to be back. Thank you very much to Rabbi Gold for being out of town this week so that I could fill in. And thank God the Skokie Yeshiva has been a wonderful year. And usually they start at 7:15 so we can learn together. But now that the Skokie Yeshiva is off, that Rabbi Gold is not giving shir this week, we have a chance to come back together to learn again. And we're in Parsha Shlach. And what we're going to look at is the most common, the most popular, the most famous question that exists in Parsha Shlach. But it's no less important. It's actually, it's common and it's famous because it is so very important. And that is what we will call the Chet HaMeraglim. What we're going to see today is going to be three approaches to this singular question. Although, as we look into it, we'll see that this one question has many details to it. And a lot of what we're going to see is going to be influenced and inspired by Rav Yitzchak Isaac Scher. Just so we understand who he was, Rav Yitzchak Isaac Scher was the son-in-law of the altar of Slobodka. He was the son-in-law of Rav Nassim C. Finkel, Sr., not the one who played basketball for Iron Crown, and was the Rosh Hashiva of the Mir. That's not really, his claim to fame is not that he played basketball, his claim to fame is that he was Rosh Hashiva, but when you're in Chicago, you got to point out all of his accolades. And he was the son-in-law, he becomes the Rosh Hashiva of Slobodka. He has a collection of svarim called Leket Sichos Musar, not Sichos Musar from Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, but Leket Sichos Musar, which is a collection of Sichos Musar, and his first volume is on the Parsha. I was listening to a shiur by Rabbi David Orlovsky, and Rabbi David Orlovsky has a certain style that works very, very well for me when I was younger, in my more nascent stages of listening to shiurim. As I've gotten older, he often sort of goes off topic. You know, he's very entertaining. I've leaned away from listening to him on a regular basis, but at one point, but his yesodos, his lessons, and what he's sharing was always so profound, always so creative, and I would often wonder, where does he get this idea from? And at one point in time, he shared that a lot of his ideas, not a lot, but frequently when he needs an idea, when he's looking for something compelling, he'll look at Rav Yitzchak Isaac Scher, he'll look at Leket Sichos Musar. And so that brought me to the Sefer. I now learn the Sefer whenever I can because he really does blow me out of the water with his approaches on the Parsha. And his approach on the Parsha this week is not particularly impressive at first, but the thought he develops is astounding. And what we're going to do is that we're going to develop Rav Yitzchak Isaac Scher's approach in this Parsha by looking at two other answers first. But first, let's just jump in. Anytime you see this kind of printout, the copy piece, if you will, that's next to his picture on top that no one can see because the coloring didn't go well, then you'll know that that's from his Sefer. And so, first and foremost, v'hine, v'cheta meraglim shehu chet hakashim u'kulam. When it comes to this sin, this mistake of the meraglim, of the scouts that are sent in our parsha, which is the most egregious sin of the Jewish people, just to think about this for a moment, what's the worst thing that's ever happened? What's the worst sin the Jewish people have ever committed? I would have said the eagle also, except what happens after the eagle? Our numbers dwindle a little bit. We lose 3,000 people. But what happens after Chet HaMeraglim?
40 years in the desert.
40 years in the desert. So which one's worse? This is tangential, but worthwhile. When we learn a lot of halakhot in the Torah, when we learn about Hilchos Shabbos, for example, a lot of times we know the gravity of a sin, we know the gravity of a mitzvah based off of its punishment. And so, realistically, Gemara tells us that a Beis Din almost never killed anyone. It was very uncommon for someone to actually be put to death, which is why what happens at the end of the parsha with the Mekoshesh Etzim is so interesting that they actually do kill him. But they rarely killed anyone, so what's the point of elucidating all of these different kinds of misos? Because what it's telling you is, this is a little bit important, this is very important. And if something is very important, if it gets skila, which is our worst of all the four punishments from the Beis Din, that's an indication that this is a very, very bad thing to do. And so the punishments of the Chet Egel versus the punishment of the sin of the Meraglim are telling us something. And it sounds like this is the Chet HaKashim Kulam because the punishment is so much worse than the punishment that we get for the Chet HaEgel. And we could contrast those, we're not going to so much, but he says, now in the end of the first line,
isn't there an opinion that basically it was after the Meraglim, we were getting paid for both, because Hashem knew we were going going to do another sin, and he just waited for the end. Because it says, by the ego, it says, when on the day that you sin, I will pay you back. So it's like we're getting. They're basically one punishment for both sins.
It's fair. You can make the same comparison to the beginning of the Torah. You have the Dor HaMabul and Dor HaFlaga in Parshas Noach, and this generation resulted in a flood, and then God said, I'm never going to flood the world again, so that when the Dor HaFlaga, when they build the tower, they're dispersed. But that might not have been that sin was not as bad, just that God had already played that card. That card was out of the game now, so this was the next best thing. So that's fair. That's fair. Still, Rav Yitzchak Isaac Chair says, Chet HaKash Mekulam. But yes, you make a good point, and I appreciate that. You know, when you talk to ninth graders, it's very rare that they can quote your Rashi that says different than what you're saying. So the contrast here is well appreciated. And so he says, Shekvar Biyanu Shechalila Lanu Lakshov Shema'osu Be'eretz Kam Dapshuta Kimashmo. The notion that these 12 men were just decided, or these 10 men decided, we don't like Israel, we're not interested, we'd rather just stay in the desert. That is not a good approach. If someone tells you that, they're not thinking about this clearly enough. They haven't done their homework well enough to assume that these people, these Nesi Ha'eda, decided that Israel's not good. Ella, Shehishtadlu Lifnei Hashem, Shelo Yisnasu B'Nisayon Kasha Zeh, Likvosh Ha'aretz B'Mochama. They tried, and they didn't want to go through the Nisayon of conquering Israel. That's what was bothering them. And within that inyan, within that concept, yesh harbe mikros v'ma'amarim mechazal shelachora kasha lepatram al pi derek zeh v'alina lisbonin bo v'lamod al omek amisasam. There are a lot of marmakomos we're going to look at, there are a lot of things in Chazal and in the Psukim that are going to illustrate to us that they weren't just being lazy, they weren't just being anti-Zionists, chas v'shalom. There was something else happening here, and it wasn't, and what he's really pointing out is this wasn't, they weren't from. They weren't Rishayim. And to assume that they were Rishayim is like a throwaway answer. It's too easy. Oh, yeah, they were bad people. That's why they did it. That's not what happened. There must have been something else going on. And a beautiful line in Emunah Bitachon, in the Chazon Ish Sefer, that's quite honestly very hard to understand in Hebrew. His Hebrew is poetic and beautiful. And if not for the English, I don't think I would ever learn Emunah Bitachon. But the Chazon Ish says that we have to learn history so we don't repeat it. He doesn't say it exactly like that, but that's the famous line. And he says, when we look at history, it informs us. And Chachamim look at history, and it tells them how they're supposed to act and what they're supposed to do. And the mistake of the Meraglim, the chait of the Meraglim that we're seeing in our Parsha, is going to be something that will influence our lives as well. It's not just going to be something that happened with 10 men 3,000 years ago, but the mistakes that they may have made, the lessons, are something that will apply to us even today. So with that, let's actually look at our Parsha. Because in beginning of Parsha Shlach, we learned that Moshe is supposed to send Anashim, and we'll jump into Pasuk Beis. Shlach lecha Anashim v'yasur ha'aretz Kanan asher ani nosein livnei Yisrael. God is seemingly sending them into Israel, and they're supposed to send these individuals. Ishachad l'matei avosav tishlach kol nasi b'hem. You're supposed to send a nasi, you're supposed to send a leader of the people. Vayishlach osam Moshe midbar paran al pi Hashem. And Moshe sends them al pi Hashem with the guidance based off of the instruction of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then this is the kicker. Kulam anoshim roshei b'nei Yisrael hema. And all of these men, all of these individuals, make no mistake, these were roshei b'nei Yisrael. They were heads of b'nei Yisrael. They were anashim. They were chashuv people. So if that's the case,
what happened?
And let's only confound it, because that's the beginning of the Aliyah, this end of the first Aliyah. We learn that Moshe does something a little surprising. Eil shmos ha'anashim, after we listed off who they all are, asher shalach Moshe lasuras aretz, that Moshe sent to scout the land, vayikra Moshe lehoshe benun Yehoshua. And Moshe gives Yehoshua a new name. Now, what does Rashi tell us? Why does Moshe give Yehoshua a new name?
To protect him.
If Moshe knew this was not going to go well, why send them in the first place? Moshe's, I'm going to send them, it's not going to go well, but I don't want Yehoshua to get messed up because I like him and he's supposed to take over, so I'm going to just give him a bracha. Putting aside the fact that seemingly you could have given all of them brachos, Don't send them if it's not going to go well. What was Moshe thinking? What was motivating him to give Yoshua this extra nun, this bracha? Because there's no way that it was to simply, the way Rashi says, that Hashem, Yoshua may atzas miraglim, that God save him from the plan of the miraglim. It wasn't that, they're bad and Moshe's good, which is definitely how you could read Rashi. We're going to see a little bit more of an elaborate approach. And just to close off with Rav Yitzchak Isaac Scher's introduction, Amnam hamistaka ba'ayin tova v'seichel yashar roa shim nifarish ha'dvarim pshutam k'mashmam. If we look at this clearly with an ayin tova and a clear mind, we'll see that if you explain things simply, harehem sosim es atma, they don't make any sense. Hamikraos amurim darsheni v'hamik achakar la'amod al sod amka. And so we're going to have to look into this more. Now let's build up a few more questions based on our page 2, based off of the report that the Meraglim bring back. Because the report is really the most confusing, most unusual part of this whole story.
But
yes.
No, it just says here, that God told Moshe to send.
Yes, why is God telling Moshe to send them? It looks like David's still there.
I mean.
Oh, okay, so maybe just the phone.
Did they obviously ask for it? I mean.
So that's a discussion that they really were asking for it, and Shlach HaNashim is God saying, yeah, fine, you can go, as opposed to God starting this. And so...
That's like in the Devarim, it says.
Yeah,
In that story that they, all Bnei Yisrael came over, the motion said, we want to send spies.
We want to send spies. Oh, okay.
That's why they did it in the first place. It was not Moshe's idea.
Right.
Bnei Yisrael came asking for it, and then Hashem said, if you want to, go ahead. But I don't think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I'm not giving my seal of approval.
That's the famous Shlach Lecha.
Right. So that language of Shlach Lecha, the Tam Vadas points out, or of Sternbach, that Shlach Lecha Anashim, like the language of Lechacha, when Avraham is told Lechacha, it's Lechacha Lahanaska. Go for yourself. It's going to be for your benefit. Did David get disconnected?
Yeah.
David? Hello? David? Hello?
Right, row.
Hi.
Well.
Okay. Are you there? Are you there now?
Well, I think you hit the headset button instead of the speaker button.
Then I hung up. Are you there now?
I'm here now.
Okay.
Sorry we lost you, David.
All right.
So just interestingly, Shlach Lecha, just like Lechacha, is for Avraham's benefit. And Rav Sternbuck says that Shlach Lecha was for Moshe's benefit. Why for Moshe's benefit? He's going to live another 38 years. It's a pretty good deal. Not such a good deal, but for Moshe, it did turn out somewhat beneficially. And so let's take a look. This is when the Meraglim come back. They've now gone on their journey, and now they're coming back, and they're reporting. And there are some very weird things in these psukim when we think about this without sort of all the baggage that we often come with. So Vayechu Vayavo El Moshe, the translation is on the bottom. V'al Aaron, they go to Moshe and Aaron. V'al kol Adas Bnei Yisrael, El Mibar Paran Kadesha, V'yashivu Osam Davar, V'es Kol Ha'eda, V'yirum Es Pri Aretz. So they come back, they give their report. It kind of sounds like it was almost like a talk show. You know, they're standing up on stage, all of Bnei Yisrael is watching, and they're just kilu talking to Moshe and Aaron. And they bring back these fruits. And Rashi tells us, Ma'u V'yelehu, L'hakish Ha'likasan L'viyasan. And this is one of those very incriminating Rashis. He tells us that the language of Yelichu means that when they left and when they came back, it was the same plan. Nothing changed, per se, says Rashi, while they were gone. Ma biyasam ba'etzara, af halikasam ba'etzara. And just like they left with a nefarious plan, so too they returned with that same nefarious plan. And just to be fair to Rashi, he's quoting the Gemara in Sota. He didn't just make this up on his own. And so this sounds very negative. This sounds like the exact opposite of what we're trying to build.
Because we said they're good people.
They're good. Doesn't sound like they're good people.
That doesn't sound like it.
Yeah. So now we continue and we say Vayisapru lo Vayomru, and so they start talking and they say Banu al Eretz Asher Shalachnu Shalachtanu V'gam Zavas Kalav Tivash Hi V'zeh Piria. We went to Israel, and sure enough, all the advertisements that we've heard about, every pamphlet that God has sent to us, is in fact true. It is a land flowing with milk and honey. And this is its fruit. This sounds like a very positive start. Moshe and Aaron are probably sitting down in their chairs saying, this is going to be great. I'm so pumped. Ephes ki oz ha'am. Hayoshev Aretz. But the nation who lives there is very mighty. The Harim Bitsuros Gedolos Ma'od, the Gam Yodeha Nakra Inusham, there are giants, and the cities are fortified. Okay. Amalek is there. Now I mention Amalek.
Because they already were attacked.
Yeah, Amalek is a sore spot for the Jewish people. The Jewish people were attacked by Amalek right after Yetzias Mitzrayim. Amalek does not feel good for us. Guess who's there? Your worst enemy, Amalek. Yosheb Ba'aretz HaNegev. V'achiti v'avi Yusfi v'amri Yosheb Bahar v'aknani Yosheb Alayam V'al Yat HaYarden. And now they're giving reports of where all of the bad guys, if you will, all of the enemies are hanging out. And then Vayas Kalev, and then Kalev gets silent, gets the nation silent. Vayomer Alona Leva Yerashni Osa. Let's go, let's do it. We are going to inherit the land, Ki Yacholnu Kol Lach, because we are capable of doing so. And so we're seeing somewhat of a contrast. They start out good, they get kind of negative. Kalev gets quiet, and in Midrashic literature, we know that Kalev is trying to stop this plan from happening. He wants to convince the Jewish people that they can do it. The Anashim Asher Aluimo Amru Lonuchal Lalos Alam Ki Chazaku Mimenu, and we're not able to go because they are stronger than us. We can't handle this. We are not strong enough, Mr. Kalev, to do this battle. And so in this final pasuk, Vayotzinu Dibata Aretz Asher Tarosa, and they speak negatively about the land. El Bnei Yisrael Lemor, and they say Haaretz Asher Avarnu Ba Lasurasa Eretz Ochelas Yoshvehi. This land eats up its inhabitants. This land that we visited is not an easy land. And everyone who's living there, they're anche midos, not to say that they're such good guys, but they are very large, they're very powerful, they are men of great measure. And let's take a look at Rashi here. This land that eats its inhabitants. Why? There were funerals everywhere. There was a funeral like every day that they were in Israel. Why? HaKadosh Baruch Hu Eitzato Asa L'Tova, thank you. K'dei L'Tardam Be'avlam V'lo Yitnu Leiv Le'ilu. These guys are scouts, they're spies, whatever terminology you want to use. The Malbim gets into that a lot, both here and in Sefer Yoshua. They're sneaking around in Israel. And so they created a diversion. The Gemara in Sota tells us that everyone's focused on funerals. Everyone was sitting Shiva. Everyone was preparing eulogies. And they didn't have time to focus on these random 12 men who were running around.
Who is Kalev again?
Kalev is one of the Meraglim. Kalev is an exceptional individual. 10 of the Meraglim are throwaway names. We don't know who they are. We never hear anything about them, obviously, after this. Yoshua is Moshe's number 2. And Kalev, we don't see that much of in Psukim, but Kalev in Gemara and in Midrashic literature is a lot. Kalev marries Miriam. Kalev is someone who's got different kind of vision and sight. Kalev we would see in Midrashim, if we didn't skip that part, he's the one who disbands from the rest of the Meraglim and goes to Hebron instead of sticking with the rest of the pack. And so there's nothing that we necessarily see about Kalev so much in the Psukim, but we see a lot of it in the Midrashim.
So he was Miriam's husband?
He marries Miriam. Yeah. He's Hur's father.
What?
His father of Hur, who really was supposed to take over the leadership of Bnei Israel, but that's a whole separate discussion.
Hur, the one they killed by the Edom. Hur,
the one they killed at the Edom.
Oh.
He was the son of Miriam and
Kalev. Right, okay.
That's who Kalev is.
And Kalev was the father?
Kalev was the father,
Okay, thank you.
So let's think about this. They start out positive, then they get negative, then Kalev says, no, it's going to go well, and then they say, no. This is an Eretz Ochel Shvera. This is a land that eats up its people. Both we can look at what Rashi says and just at the land itself. It's not just, oh, people are dying there. There's something seemingly wrong with the land. The land is uninhabitable, if we may. So this is a very negative report. It doesn't go well, and the Jewish people are ultimately punished for it. And I think if we spend a little more time thinking about this report and thinking about this story, something new might come to light. And I'm not convinced that this report was negative, at the very least until Kalev starts speaking. I think before Kalev, I'm not positive that it was bad. But we'll have to wait for that. First, we're going to see an answer from the Tam Vadas. This is not an answer from the Tam Vadas from Rav Sternbuch. This is an answer that Kimat everyone says. The first time I encountered it was in the Sefer Nesivos Shalom and then in the Sfas Emes. And we could go on more, but this is something that exists in the Zohar Kodesh. And therefore, many people quote it. This might be amongst the more famous Zohars because it's one of the most compelling explanations of what happened. And even though it only gets a very little real estate on our page, it's obviously a very important thing to consider. What happened? How does the Meraglim, these great men, bring back a negative report? Well, let's think about this.
It says they recounted to him.
Yes.
And they said.
Yes.
So it doesn't say that Joshua and Caleb recounted.
Right.
It says they recounted. So that would imply that they all recounted to him.
Perhaps. And again, I'm not convinced that Yoshua and Caleb were not speaking in these first two lines. Many people assume that if we were going to...
Well, the word Ephes is usually considered a negative.
Correct. I think if we were to make a screenplay of this scene, you know, speaking lines would... You'd have, you know, Caleb and Yoshua on one side and the 10 other on the other side, and they're almost yelling back and forth. I'm not convinced that that's happening right in the beginning. I think that it might have been a collective discussion. But we'll see how that works out once we get to Rav Yitzchak Isaac Scher. First, we're going to look at this Zohar through Rav Sternbuch. I just like the way that he phrased it. You know, in Sivo Shalom, Chassidish Rebbe, he takes a little too long to get to his point. This is tachlis. One paragraph, he tells you everything you need to know. So what happened with these Meraglim? What happened? These are leaders of the nation. They were chashev men. They were senators. They were governors. They were dignitaries. It was a good life. And Zohar Kodesh Mevarish and Yisi Yisrael Nikshalu L'davar Sarah Beretz Yisrael. How did they mess up? Sheyedu Shebaaretz Lo Yuchanu Od Kinesiim. That they no longer be in charge. And while this is a very powerful answer, it's also probably something that we might have heard before. But let's unpack it for a moment. They're living a good life. They're in charge. They're the people who were sent. Maybe they're good at leading a desert nation, but who says that they'll be able to lead an agricultural nation? The Jewish people, everything's going to change now. And now they're going to be spread out all over the country. And who's to say that I'm still going to have the same position that I had beforehand? That's a negative way to look at it. There's a more positive light to take. And not just that they were Shelo Yichanu Od Kinesiim. This language of Yichanu is a language of Kohen. Someone pointed out to me last week that the Rambam at the end of the Halakos of Shemitah and Yovel says if anyone wants to be a Kohen, they can. What does it mean to be a Kohen? In the Rambam's terminology at the end of those Halakos, someone who wants to dedicate themselves entirely to a Kodesh Baruch Hu, wants to learn, wants to serve the B'nai Israel, they can become a Kohen. A Kohen literally means, we say priest. A Kohen is not a servant. That's not the right word. It's a better word. But a Kohen is someone who's serving a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And so when we talk about Kohanim in the Beis HaMikdash, they're serving a Kodesh Baruch Hu as the people of the Beis HaMikdash. But if someone wants to be a Kohen, they can serve a Kodesh Baruch Hu by learning Torah all the time, by teaching Torah, by living an exclusively Torah lifestyle. So says the Rambam. And this language of Yichanu, I don't think is a coincidence, that they were concerned that they would no longer be able to be Kohanim, not in the lofty dignitary sense, but perhaps somewhat differently. Because let's think about this for a moment. What was it like being in the desert? What was that experience like for the Jewish people?
Well, they were taken care of. I mean,
not bad. Food, mud. Water, you had the main Miriam. And in terms of shelter, you had the Anani HaKavod. I don't know. So if you don't need to worry about food, shelter, clothing, the Anani HaKavod would clean their clothing, and the clothing would grow with them. They were never going on to weekend sales. They didn't have to worry about it because they always had clothing. So what are you worried about? What are you doing all day? They were learning all the time. They were hanging out with Moshe Rabbeinu, not the Gadol Hador, the Gadol Hadoros, the greatest Torah individual that's ever lived. It was great. It was awesome. They were living purely Torah lives, and this messaging, I didn't get it from the Tam Vadas then, but this messaging I first saw in the Nesivos Shalom, you know, when I was what we call freshback, you know, when you spent, I spent 2 years in yeshiva, I was effectively in this same desert experience. I was learning all the time. I was davening. I had very little else I needed to worry about. A friend of mine commented that when you're in yeshiva at Netiv Aryeh, they take care of everything except actually making sure you eat. But otherwise, they got it covered. As long as you make sure to put the food in your mouth, then you're all set. And I was very engaged in that experience. I didn't really want to be in any kind of other experience. I was not thrilled that I was now in college. You know, I was young. And that passion and excitement was necessary and helpful at the time. But this was actually very gratifying because this lesson that the Meraglim basically said, you know, we want to be in the desert. We want to be in that yeshiva in Israel experience, if you will. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu basically says, that's not how this works. That was an important experience. It's a transformative experience for the Jewish people. That journey through the desert, as we'll see in the next piece, is supposed to happen, and they're supposed to have that intense, very engaged, all-encompassing Torah, mitzvos, exposure, and experience while in the desert. They're supposed to be within the Anani HaKavod or the Kosel HaBeis Medrash. Then they're supposed to go to Israel. They're supposed to lead a full life and supposed to be farmers and still engage in that those Torah mitzvahs, still engage in that Jewish experience, but in a life that's more balanced, in a life that requires something more of us. You know, if all else is equal, if we're fair weather fans and just life happens to be very easy right now, it's great that I'm engaged, that I'm from. But as soon as adversity comes, that doesn't really mean much. One of the things that they used to say a lot when I was in Yeshiva University, one of the things I greatly appreciated was that being in YU is a lot like real life. It's not exactly the same. You know, you spend more time learning in YU than most people are able to outside. But you have afternoon responsibilities, you've got things going on, and there are times where it gets very intense, and there's a lot. And just like there's busy season for accountants in what used to be like, you know, March, April, which now seems to start in like February, Baruch Hashem, I didn't go into accounting because busy season for sure got longer. I don't know how, but it did. And there's busy season, and so then you have to figure out your commitments to family, but to minyanim and shirim. And so too, in college, you have midterms and finals. And Rabbi Menachem Penner often says that this is like a simulation of what your life will be like, except you still have that structure. And so even in times where I faltered, where I didn't do as well, I still had that yeshiva structure within my university that I could fall back on. And so I greatly appreciated that. But that message of, yes, be in the desert for 2 years, give or take, and then go into Israel, and then live a fuller life, live a life of more responsibilities with balance, that was a very, very empowering message for me at that time in my life. And that's our...
Sort of like my focus on the Gemara was
Rabbi Shimon. Yes, yes. Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yishmael. Yes, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochanan, Rabbi Shmuel, and where the conversation is, should you spend all of your life, all of your time just committed to Torah and mitzvos, or should you have a profession and spend 2 months a year learning? Just 2 months a year only learning. That was the presumption that Rabbi Yishmael was making. And the Gemara ultimately says, a lot of people tried to be like Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, maybe not literally living in a cave, but tried to be that fully engaged, nothing but Torah attitude. And it didn't work for them. V'lo alulam. And Kodesh Baruch Hu wants certain people to just sit and learn Torah. Rav Chaim Kanievsky, Zatzal, was planning on becoming, I don't know, like a Rosh Yeshiva, like a Magachir. His father told him, no, you're supposed to sit and learn and do nothing else. But even Rav Chaim Kanievsky was not expecting to be Rav Chaim Kanievsky to just sit and learn all day. That was only after the stipler told him that you're chelik in the world. Kodesh Baruch Hu wants you to just learn and do absolutely nothing else. Most of us are not Rav Chaim Kanievsky's. No, none of us are. And so it's about figuring out what is the balance that Kodesh Baruch Hu wants for me. And part of me would have loved to be like a kol guy in Israel. I like to think that Kodesh Baruch Hu wanted me doing something else. So that's going to be our first approach. That the Meraglim either didn't want to lose their position of greatness, or they didn't want to stop being Kohanim in the sense of an all-encompassing Jewish experience without really any struggle, without having to balance. That's answer number one. We might have heard that answer before. The second one, I don't know that you heard before. It's quite creative and enjoyable. We're not going to read the whole thing inside, but it's based off of a Gemara in Brachos. A Gemara in Brachos we've almost definitely heard before, and this is all from Sefer Sarei Alefim. This is actually from email Sarei Alefim, because the Sefer is only in Hebrew, but I decided to make it as a Sefer. Rabbi Ephraim Twersky of Kahal Hasidim is an exceptional Baal Machadesh. He comes up with very impressive, very creative Divrei Torah. Happens to be that this one's not his. And he's quoting the Katzker on this one. But there are a few people that I read, but also a few people that I've actually interacted with. He's like a real person and personable and engaging, who have such incredible creative Divrei Torah. And he looks at the Gemara in Brachos on Daf Lamed Daled Amud Beis, which tells us something we've heard before. It comes up a few months from now, that B'makom shebaal tshuva omdim ein tzadikim gemurim yecholim lamod. That in the place of baal tshuva, of people who are involved in tshuva, tzadikim gemurim, a fully righteous individual, cannot possibly stand. What does that mean? The Kutzker has a whole different approach. Because ordinarily I would have said that line means that there's something special about a baal tshuva, something special about someone who, in the language of Chazal, tam ta'am yisura, they tasted what it's like to, they tasted literal isra. They went to McDonald's, although I can't imagine that a Big Mac is like really so impressive. But from what I hear, the French fries are out of this world. They went to the McDonald's, they had the French fries. They've done all the other isurim in the book. They have watched Saturday morning cartoons. They know how good life could be when you're not osik and Torah mitzvos. And still, they're committed. That's very impressive. Tzadikim can't appreciate that. If you live your whole life, you're an FFB, you're from birth, you don't get that same feel because you don't know what you're missing. Now, we're not encouraging anyone to raise their children in such a manner, but that's how people read this Gemara. That's not how the Kutzker looks at this Gemara, because if we can appreciate the journey the B'nai Israel are on, like we said, B'nai Israel from Mitzrayim until Israel are supposed to be doing something. It wasn't just a logistical journey of we have to get from point A to point B. There are stops along the way. There are things that happen. Kodesh Baruch Hu is trying to take the Mitzrayim out of the Jewish people and turn them into something else once they arrive in Eretz Yisrael. And one thing that he's trying to take out of them is that notion of bitterness, of mar. The Jewish people come out of Egypt and they're bitter. Now, it makes sense that they're bitter. They've been enslaved for two centuries. But they're bitter. And how do we see that they're bitter? Not in the source sheet.
Keep complaining all the time.
They're complaining. Specifically, the very first complaint in Parshas B'Shalach, they just left and they're not able to drink the water. Pasuk says, Ki marim heim. Because they are bitter. Now, what is they referring to? What are heim? So we would assume that's the water, and it is the water. They could not drink the water because it was mar, because it was bitter. However, the Baal Shem Tov, this might be amongst the most famous of the Baal Shem Tov sayings. Baal Shem Tov said, when it says ki marim heim, because they were bitter, he doesn't talk about the water, he's talking about the people. The people were bitter, and they saw everything in a negative light. When you're bitter, you see things negatively. And what Rabbi Twersky is suggesting to us from the Kutzker, and we'll just read this bold on the top, he says that tzaddikim can't stand where baal tshuva stand because baal tshuva are burning garbage, which smells so bad that tzaddikim can't stand there. Now, he's not referring to baal tshuva who have now accomplished, who now sort of arrived. I know people who were not Shomer Shabbos and are now Shomer Shabbos, but don't think of themselves as baal tshuva, maybe because they're not all in, if you will. You know, they're at like 85%, not 100%. But there's still certain halakhos they're not so good about. They don't know as much as they maybe think that they should. And so, as far as they're concerned, they didn't used to be from, and now they are, but they're not baal tshuva, because a baal tshuva sounds like you've arrived somewhere. I think we talked about that once. I think here, actually. But when he's saying baal tshuva, he's talking about people who are actively involved in regret, in the bitterness of the life that they once lived. It's unfortunate, so many times you'll have people who don't grow up in a Torah mitzvot environment and do find it, and they look back and they're so upset about the fact that they missed out on it. That, oh, I didn't have this when I was a kid. You know, my family isn't like these other from families, and they're burning garbage. They're so upset about it. They're so bitter. One of the marks of a tzaddik is a positive outlook. It's about seeing things from the good. This past 2 weeks, I was in a fellowship. Fellowship's not the right word. I was in a cohort of educators through the Sachs Herrenstein Foundation, a Rabbi Sachs Memorial Foundation, basically spreading Torah of Rabbi Sachs, led by Dr. Erica Brown and Dr. Shira Weiss. They're both exceptional scholars and educators. And so there was this thing going on. I decided to opt in. So 4 sessions over 2 weeks. And we were learning Torah of Rabbi Sacks, along with Torah of you know, Shlomo HaMelech and David HaMelech, and we looked at Eov. We looked at a lot of things, but a lot of times things were processed through the lens of Rabbi Sacks and other modern-day scholars. And they shared a lot of quotes with us. I guess, like, they're holding in, like, the Shas of Rabbi Sacks. You know, they talk about Rav Kook's Svarim. Rav Kook's Svarim were all published in white. At least now they're all published in white. And so they call it the Shas Lavan, that, you know, you have all the Torah of Rav Kook in these Svarim. So I guess Erica Brown's holding in all of the Rabbi Sacks Svarim. She had quotes from basically every one of his books. And one of the books that he shared, I'm not going to say it as well, because no one says anything as well as Rabbi Sacks did, and I'm not even going to articulate it in the way that he wrote it, but effectively that Yiddishkeit, a Jew, doesn't look at the world the way it is, but the way that it could be. It's about seeing the potential shebo. A tzaddik is someone who sees the potential within themselves, within an item. They see that a cup of water is a potential for a mitzvah. They see, look inside a person and see the potential for mitzvos that they can accomplish, that they can fulfill. And he says, now in the bold further down, the spies were a test. How would they see the land? Would they focus on the positive or the negative? If they focused on the positive, that would show we'd gotten out of our bitterness from Mitzrayim. But the Meraglim come back and they're bitter. And they point out the negative. And that was a failed test. Not even so much about Israel, but that they still have this negative perspective. And if you still have this negative perspective, the tahara, if you will, you know, the purification process that was supposed to take place while traveling through the desert clearly has not stuck, and so we're not going to be able to continue. We're going to have to stay in the desert longer and work on this purification process. We might just need to scrap it and try over again, and that all of the men in this generation are going to have to just go away. And so that's our second approach. It's a beautiful story that kind of caps this off with Rav Kook. We've probably heard the story before. Rav Kook was chief rabbi of Israel, pre-Israel, and it was great, but it wasn't so great. It wasn't so easy. Things were not so easy. People didn't have so much money. There was a British mandate going on, and people had a rough time. And Rav Kook was a source of warmth and positivity. He's always smiling. One day, a reporter comes into his office and effectively asks him, Rabbi, how do you stay so positive all the time? So you might have heard this story. Rav Kook takes a pen, bold move, but I guess it's his office, and puts it on the wall. And says, what do you see? Reporter says, I see a dot on the wall. And he says, you can choose to focus on the one little piece of black on the wall. I choose to see the white surrounding it. There's always going to be something to complain about. There's always something that didn't go right. But we have the opportunity to see things for the good rather than for the bad. We can have an ayin tova. And that's the mistake that the Meraglim made. Well, I'd count for that. And let's see if we can answer our real question. Because now we're going to look at Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Shear. We're not going to be able to read through everything I put here, but I guess we'll call it homework. And it starts and ends with a line from the Tzidkas HaTzadik. And we'll just preface the Tzidkas HaTzadik that Rabbi David Beshefkin frequently shares the first time he ever learned any Torah from Rabbi Tzadok, where Moshe Weinberger was teaching a Mishmar in DRS. He's teaching a bunch of high school boys. You can imagine Rabbi Frank Tversky going to Skokie Yeshiva for a Mishmar. And they're all learning Sefer Tzidkas HaTzadik, and they've got Chinese food. And at one point he stops and he says, boys, everyone's got to put their food away. This line in the Tzidkas HaTzadik cannot be learned while eating Chinese food. But Rabbi Shevkin, as a high school boy, couldn't believe that there was Torah that you could not learn while also eating Chinese food. This must be something special. This must be something worth looking at. And this is one of the most compelling lines I've ever seen in Rabbi Tzadok. Just like a person needs to believe in a Kodesh Baruch Hu, and to every all extent that it means to believe in a Kodesh Baruch Hu, kach tzarech achar kach lahamin ba'atzmo. So too, we have to believe in ourselves. Just like we have to believe in a Kodesh Baruch Hu, we have to believe in ourselves. The Meraglim's mistake was that they did not believe in themselves. Let's take a look and see how that plays out. Jumping in the middle of the first line, Leman Havinas Inyan Shlikos Meraglim Alenu Lasim Lev L'Divrei Rishonim Shekasvu Al Anisim Shekadosh Baruch Hu Osei Met Tzadikim. We got to think about what miracles does God make for the tzadikim. I'm reading a little bit faster because we're running a little bit late. Shehem Ne'arachim Lefi Midas Hadveikus Sheish L'Tzadikim Be'Ava V'Yir L'Fnei Hashem. Hakadosh Baruch Hu's miracles seem to be consistent with the level of dveikus, the level of kedusha, the level of connection people have with Hakadosh Baruch Hu. Shkvishir dve kusum ba'ashem b'midazu yishlem ha'koach l'shanus ha'teva ha'olam l'tfilasam kiritzonam. The world will change depending on how impressive you are. And there's a beautiful story that in Chabad Chassidus, the Baal Shem Tov is traveling along. He encounters an inn, and the innkeeper is a simple Jew. He says, I don't know how to daven properly. I guess Archibald wasn't around then. And he says, I have the whole sitter. I've been saying the whole sitter every day because I don't know when I'm supposed to what's special for Monday, Thursday, what it's supposed to be with a minion. I don't know what I'm supposed to say and not say, so I say everything. So the Baal Shem Tov spends an hour, and he writes lots of little sticky notes and puts it into the sitter so that the guy knows exactly what he's supposed to say and when, so that his davening is not so long, not so elaborate. And then the Baal Shem Tov leaves. So thank you very much. And he makes his way. And as the door is closing, the sitter falls over. All the little papers fly away. Hours work out the window. The guy is so disappointed, and now he's not going to know how to daven properly. So he's not willing to give up. He runs after the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov is already moving on his way. And the Baal Shem Tov encounters a river. And the guy says, perfect. He's at a crossroads. He's going to have to figure out, some other way. He can't go to the river. He's going to turn around and I'll catch him. So he's going, and he's excited he's going to catch the Baal Shem Tov. And then the Baal Shem Tov takes off his gartel, lays it onto the water, steps on it, and glides across and continues walking. And the guy's like, oh no! And so he takes off his gartel, puts it on the water, and glides across, and then catches the Baal Shem Tov. Baal Shem Tov was, how'd you get here? And he's like, well, I just did what you did. You glid across the water. That was a good move, by the way. I did the same thing. Now, I lost the papers for my sitter. Can you please tell me what I'm supposed to say in my davening? To which the Baal Shem Tov responds, I think the Kodesh Baruch is very happy with the way you're davening now. The more davening we are to Kodesh Baruch Hu, the more connected we are to Kodesh Baruch Hu, the more miracles will happen. And so, with that notion, let's think about this. There's a great line that my Rebbe had in his office growing up. Don't tell God how big your problems are. Tell your problems how big your God is. The bigger your HaKadosh Baruch Hu is for you, the more they will deal with your problems. The more the HaKadosh Baruch Hu can handle it, the more bitachon, the more faith we're going to have. So let's think about this plan, because with that frame, a lot of it will make sense. And now in source 6, again, middle of the line, Halo efshar lahem lelechas beinayim atzumos acharei Hashem haholik lifneihem. They could have walked blindfolded around Israel. What was the point? Why are they talking about the natural ways of conquering? Who cares where anyone is? Kodesh Baruch Hu is going to take care of this. Kodesh Baruch Hu gave them the man. Kodesh Baruch Hu gave them the water. God's taking care of everything. He fought the Egyptians. The Jewish people didn't do anything when they left Egypt. Why would you assume that you're going to fight the Meraglim instead of assuming that a Kodesh Baruch Hu is going to fight the people who are currently living in Israel? Ella Hakol Baruch Nius. This was the goal of this was not a gashmi. It wasn't a physical plan. We're going to scout out what we need to do to conquer this land. It was a spiritual plan. La Daas Ad Hechan Aleihem La Hagia Bekdusha Uvidvekus La Hashem Yisbarach Lefinisim Shaleim Letzapos Sheyaseh Lahem Hashem. How frum do we need to be? How much of a miracle is God going to make for us to conquer this land of Israel? How big of a miracle will God have to create? Is it going to be bigger than Kriyas Yamsuf? Is this going to be the biggest miracle ever? Or is it Kriyas Yamsuf and now we have depreciating miracles going forward? Gam pakhtu b'yuras chetam, shema yigrom hachet, v'shema lo yatzlichu la'amod b'nisayon ha'machama. And with this understanding, with this frame of the goal of sending them from the first place, the reason why Moshe sends them or Kodesh Baruch Hu sends them is to illustrate to the Jewish people that this is going to be a big miracle, that we're going to need a big miracle. Look at how much a Kodesh Baruch Hu is doing for me. If that's the goal of sending the Meraglim, their report is actually pretty appropriate. How does the report start? They say, great land, super awesome, we're super excited. Understand, it's not going to be easy that these cities are fortified, there are giants there. We don't even know if we can really fight them. Now, let's imagine they're tzaddikim for a moment. What are they really saying? We can't do this on our own. Jewish people, if you want to go into Israel, we're going to need to have an extra hour of night seder every night. Davening is going to be 15 minutes longer. And you know what? We're doing a Lashon Hara campaign. From now until we conquer Israel, no more Lashon Hara for anyone. They're inspiring the Jewish people. They're trying to convince them, we need to be better. We need to be tzaddikim, because otherwise we're not going to. There's a yiras chet. If we mess up, if we're not on the holy level to conquer Israel, we will fail. So Jewish people, let's up our game. Let's step it up. V'lachein, after the underline. Hiskach movi shtadlu b'shlichus ha-meraglim. So there was a plan in the meraglim. Liros be'ezit derech v'ezit ir alechas v'lilchom shlo yitztarku l'nisim gedolim kokach. And they get a little nervous. You know what? Let's check out the land, not just to bring back that inspiring report. Look, in case it doesn't go well, maybe if we're not super tzadikim, let's figure out what we might need to. Let's make a little bit of a military plan. They hedge their bet. Maybe we're not going to get some miracle like we saw in Yericho. Maybe we're not going to do something, going to be such righteous individuals that a Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to give us such an awesome open miracle. And even though the plan was to inspire, they themselves get a little nervous. You can't inspire someone if you're not, you yourself are not inspired. You can't show someone the way if you don't really understand the path. And what happens is that they're not convinced that they're firm enough, that they're good enough. They didn't believe in themselves that they would be worthy of the redemption from a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And we're not going to read this top, the top of seven inside, but we're at the bottom. Why does Moshe give, you know, we asked the question, why does Moshe give this blessing to Yoshua? Yoshua was an Anav. Yoshua was the student of Moshe Rabbeinu. Yoshua would never have thought that he would be good enough. And someone who's an Anav doesn't think of themselves as a tzaddik. They say about the Chavetz Chaim, Chavetz Chaim was the Galah Dor, he was the biggest Talmid Chacham in the generation, he was also the biggest tzaddik in the generation. And people knew that he was a tzaddik, they didn't know he was a Talmid Chacham. Why? Because the Chavetz Chaim himself said, I'm a Talmid Chacham, I know I'm a Talmid Chacham. Anytime I talk to somebody learning, I can learn circles around them. So I'm going to hide the fact that I'm a Talmid Chacham. I'm not going to share that with people. But everyone knew he was a tzaddik. Why? Because he didn't think of himself as a tzaddik. He didn't think of himself as being anyone special. He just did his thing. And he thought that it was okay. It was not bad. Everyone else looks at this and says, oh my gosh, this guy's the God of the door. But when you're an Anav, like the Chavetz Chaim, like Yoshua, I don't know if there's a little Havdil there or not, but in every generation, you don't think of yourself as being so great. So Moshe tells Yoshua, I'm putting a yud in your name. You've got a Hashem in your name. And that's going to show you that you are good enough, that you are special, you are holy, and that you are good enough to have the schus of Bnei Israel being saved when we go into Israel, of winning this war. That's the confidence that Moshe instills in Yehoshua. The rest of the Meraglim, they falter. Why? Let's take a look in this second paragraph in 7. What causes their mistake? When do they fall apart? This is on page 5 in the middle. Berak kishayatum lifnei Moshe nekshal b'machshava bilti hogenes. When does this plan fall apart? Because at a certain point in time, the Ragam conclude that they're not holy enough, that they're not going to be able to do this, that this is not going to work. When does that happen? As soon as they leave Moshe. When they're no longer with Moshe Rabbeinu, they no longer believe in themselves. It's very important at any age of life, at any stage in life, to connect yourself to people who make you believe that you can do more, who make you believe in yourself. And sometimes that's a Rebbe, but sometimes it's a friend. Hopefully it's a spouse. But Moshe Rabbeinu instilled within these Nasiim, we can do anything. We're going to be able to do this. This is going to be great. But they leave Moshe, and they're walking around in Israel, and they're not so sure. They're not totally convinced that they're really good enough. And not just that they're not good enough, that maybe, in the bold second line, Ki kasha hayalahem lahamin shekol ha'am kulo yamdu al madrigasim ha'gavoha B'shas milchama, k'mo b'shas shalom b'shalva. Maybe the Jewish people aren't up to snuff. Forget me. Maybe I'll be good enough. I trust myself, but I don't know that I trust the rest of the Jewish people. One of the things that this does is that it takes this story into a more global sense. Why is the second base of the Hamikdash destroyed? Second base of Hamikdash? So sinas chinam. This event is the first Tisha B'Av, is the first destruction, if you will. And seemingly there should be a connection between the two. There should be some connection between what happens in the sin of the spies and the destruction of the Second Temple. The same sin should be happening. Where's the sinas chinam? Where's the baseless hatred from the Second Temple that's happening here? I wonder if it's happening right now. If the Nesiim say, I don't believe the Jewish people can do it. Maybe it's not sinas chinam in the same sense. It's not baseless hatred, but it's not believing the Jewish people enough. It's not seeing that they can really do accomplish. And so the Meraglim, they say, I don't think B'nai Israel's up to snuff. I don't think they're going to cut it. And so maybe their report starts positively, but it's not going well. And so Kalev changes tactics. And the Jewish people, when they hear that it's going to be a challenge, instead of saying we're up to the challenge, they're like, I don't know. You know, I watch late night, and so if we do night sitter longer, I'm going to miss my show. I don't think that's going to work. People really like speaking Lashon Hara, and they're starting to falter in their commitment. And so Kalev tries to get them quiet, and he says, no, we can do this. This is going to be great. And B'nai Israel aren't having it. And at that point in time, I think the Meraglim falter, and they say, this isn't going to work. If you're not able to be committed, if you're not able to be, quote-unquote, firm enough, then a Kodesh Baruch Hu is not going to create miracles for us, and we can't go in. It doesn't track. There are certain things we need in this equation, and you guys are not filling your role. What this gets at, though, is what we'll see in the bottom, just to recap before we wrap up, that we saw three approaches. Approach number one, that they didn't want to leave the cushy environment, the all-encompassing Torah environment of the desert of the Anan HaKavod, where Kodesh Baruch Hu took care of everything and they could just learn Torah all day. That was number one, why they didn't want to leave. Number two, based on Rabbi Twersky, that they didn't want, that they had just had a negative outlook on things, that tzaddikim see things positively and they were looking at things from a bitter perspective. Number three, which I find much more compelling from Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Sher, that they didn't believe that they were holy enough. And they certainly didn't believe that B'nai Yisrael were holy enough. And that really is the mistake that people make always, all the time. That we're all convinced at every stage of life that we are not as good as we could be or that we should be. My Rebbe Chaim Eisenstein says that he thinks people in their lives only measure up to about 10% of their potential. 10% of their potential. But we can do so much more. And we're close with two quotes. One from Marianne Williamson, it's one of my favorite poems, and then from Rabbi Sachs, because I have to bang for my buck for this program I was in. And she says, our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. Maybe the Meraglim were not scared. Maybe the Jewish people were not scared that they weren't good enough. Maybe they were scared of, if I am that good, what is that going to mean? What am I going to have to do in order to be great? And if we really don't believe in ourselves, at the very least, someone else does. Because Rabbi Sachs tells us in Faith in the Future, on page 73, creation testifies not merely to God's power, but as it were, to his belief in mankind. At the heart of religion is not just the faith that we have in God, no less significant is the faith God has in us. If Kodesh Baruch Hu wanted us to go into Israel, if Kodesh Baruch Hu said you're going to need to be very firm to acquire all these nisim v'niflos, we could have done it. And the mistake of the Meraglim is the mistake that humankind makes all the time, that Jews make each and every day, unfortunately, of not thinking that they're good enough. And the very last thing I'll share with you is that Rav Yaakov Adis, who's a Mekubal living today, says that the goal of the Yetzer Hara today is not to convince us to do averos. Particularly if you live in like a robust Jewish environment, there are plenty of ways to stay strong, to not be nechshol be'avera. There are filters, there's kosher food, there's all the things that you might need. The goal of the Torah today is to convince us that our mitzvos don't mean anything. Don't do averos, but don't bother doing mitzvos, because what does it matter? Hopefully, after learning together today, we'll appreciate the tremendous value of the mitzvos that we perform. Yeah. Good Shabbos.
Thank you, Dave.